9/11 Report. Chapter 13. How to Do It. A Different Way of Organizing the Government. As presently configured, the national security institutions of the U.S. government are still the institutions constructed to win the Cold War. The United States confronts a very different world today. Instead of facing a few very dangerous adversaries, the United States confronts a number of less visible challenges that surpass the boundaries of traditional nation-states and call for quick, imaginative, and agile responses. The men and women of the World War II generation rose to the challenges of the 1940s and 1950s. They restructured the government so that it could protect the country. That is now the job of the generation that experienced 9/11. Those attacks showed, emphatically, that ways of doing business rooted in a different era are just not good enough. Americans should not settle for incremental, ad hoc adjustments to a system designed generations ago for a world that no longer exists. We recommend significant changes in the organization of the government. We know that the quality of the people is more important than the quality of the wiring diagrams. Some of the saddest aspects of the 9/11 story are the outstanding efforts of so many individual officials straining, often without success, against the boundaries of the possible. Good people can overcome bad structures. They should not have to. The United States has the resources and the people. The government should combine them more effectively, achieving unity of effort. We offer 5 major recommendations to do that. Unifying strategic intelligence and operational planning against Islamist terrorists across the foreign domestic divide with a national counterterrorism center, unifying the intelligence community with a new national intelligence director, unifying the many participants in the counterterrorism effort and their knowledge in a network-based information sharing system that transcends traditional governmental boundaries, unifying and strengthening congressional oversight to improve quality and accountability, and strengthening the FBI and Homeland Defenders. 13.1 Unity of Effort Across the Foreign Domestic Divide. Joint Action. Much of the public commentary about the 9/11 attacks has dealt with lost opportunities, some of which we reviewed in Chapter 11. These are often characterized as problems of watchlisting, of information sharing, or of connecting the dots. In Chapter 11 we explained that these labels are too narrow. They describe the symptoms, not the disease. In each of our examples, no one was firmly in charge of managing the case and able to draw relevant intelligence from anywhere in the government, assign responsibilities across the agency's foreign or domestic, track progress, and quickly bring obstacles up to the level where they could be resolved. Responsibility and accountability were diffuse. The agencies cooperated, some of the time. But even such cooperation as there was is not the same thing as joint action. When agencies cooperate, one defines the problem and seeks help with it. When they act jointly, the problem and options for action are defined differently from the start. Individuals from different backgrounds come together in analyzing a case and planning how to manage it. In our hearings we regularly asked witnesses, who is the quarterback? The other players are in their positions, doing their jobs. But who is calling the play, that assigns roles to help them execute as a team? Since 9/11, those issues have not been resolved. In some ways joint work has gotten better, and in some ways worse. The effort of fighting terrorism has flooded over many of the usual agency boundaries, because of its sheer quantity and energy. Attitudes have changed. Officials are keenly conscious of trying to avoid the mistakes of 9/11. They try to share information. They circulate, even to the president, practically every reported threat, however dubious. Partly because of all this effort, the challenge of coordinating it has multiplied. Before 9/11, the CIA was plainly the lead agency confronting Al-Qaeda. The FBI played a very secondary role. The engagement of the Departments of Defense and State was more episodic. Today the CIA is still central. But the FBI is much more active, along with other parts of the Justice Department. The Defense Department effort is now enormous. Three of its unified commands, each headed by a four-star general, have counterterrorism as a primary mission: Special Operations Command, Central Command both headquartered in Florida, and Northern Command headquartered in Colorado. A new Department of Homeland Security combines formidable resources in border and transportation security, along with analysis of domestic vulnerability and other tasks. The State Department has the lead on many of the foreign policy tasks we described in Chapter 12. At the White House, the National Security Council NSC now is joined by a parallel presidential advisory structure, the Homeland Security Council. So far we have mentioned two reasons for joint action: the virtue of joint planning and the advantage of having someone in charge to ensure a unified effort. There is a third: the simple shortage of experts with sufficient skills. The limited pool of critical experts, for example, skilled counterterrorism analysts and linguists, is being depleted. Expanding these capabilities will require not just money, but time. Primary responsibility for terrorism analysis has been assigned to the Terrorist Threat Integration Center, TTIC, created in 2003. Based at the CIA headquarters but staffed with representatives of many agencies, reporting directly to the Director of Central Intelligence. Yet the CIA houses another intelligence fusion center, the Counterterrorist Center, that played such a key role before 9/11. A third major analytic unit is at Defense, in the Defense Intelligence Agency. A fourth, concentrating more on homeland vulnerabilities, is at the Department of Homeland Security. The FBI is in the process of building the analytic capability it has long lacked, and it also has the Terrorist Screening Center. One, the U.S. government cannot afford so much duplication of effort. There are not enough experienced experts to go around. The duplication also places extra demands on already hard-pressed single-source national technical intelligence collectors like the National Security Agency. Combining joint intelligence and joint action. A smart government would integrate all sources of information to see the enemy as a whole. Integrated all-source analysis should also inform and shape strategies to collect more intelligence. Yet the Terrorist Threat Integration Center, while it has primary responsibility for terrorism analysis, is formally proscribed from having any oversight or operational authority, and is not part of any operational entity, other than reporting to the Director of Central Intelligence. The government now tries to handle the problem of joint management, informed by analysis of intelligence from all sources, in two ways. First, agencies with lead responsibility for certain problems have constructed their own interagency entities and task forces in order to get cooperation. The Counterterrorist Center at CIA, for example, recruits liaison officers from throughout the intelligence community. The Military Central Command has its own interagency center, recruiting liaison officers from all the agencies from which it might need help. The FBI has joint terrorism task forces in 84 locations to coordinate the activities of other agencies when action may be required. Second, the problem of joint operational planning is often passed to the White House, where the NSC staff tries to play this role. The National Security staff at the White House, both NSC and new Homeland Security Council staff, has already become 50% larger since 9/11. But our impression, after talking to serving officials, is that even this enlarged staff is consumed by meetings on day-to-day issues, sifting each day's threat information, and trying to coordinate everyday operations. Even as it crowds into every square inch of available office space, the NSC staff is still not sized or funded to be an executive agency. In Chapter 3 we described some of the problems that arose in the 1980s when a White House staff, constitutionally insulated from the usual mechanisms of oversight, became involved in direct operations. During the 1990s Richard Clark occasionally tried to exercise such authority, sometimes successfully, but often causing friction. Yet a subtler and more serious danger is that as the NSC staff is consumed by these day-to-day tasks, it has less capacity to find the time and detachment needed to advise a president on larger policy issues. That means less time to work on major new initiatives, help with legislative management, to steer needed bills through Congress, and track the design and implementation of the strategic plans for regions, countries, and issues that we discuss in Chapter 12. Much of the job of operational coordination remains with the agencies, especially the CIA. Their 601 tenant and his chief aides ran interagency meetings nearly every day to coordinate much of the government's day-to-day work. The 601 insisted he did not make policy and only oversaw its implementation. In the struggle against terrorism, these distinctions seem increasingly artificial. Also, as the 601 becomes a lead coordinator of the government's operations, it becomes harder to play all the position's other roles, including that of analyst-in-chief. The problem is nearly intractable because of the way the government is currently structured. Lines of operational authority run to the expanding executive departments, and they are guarded for understandable reasons. The 601 commands the CIA's personnel overseas. The Secretary of Defense will not yield to others in conveying commands to military forces. The Justice Department will not give up the responsibility of deciding whether to seek arrest warrants. But the result is that each agency or department needs its own intelligence apparatus to support the performance of its duties. It is hard to break down stovepipes when there are so many stoves that are legally and politically entitled to have cast iron pipes of their own. Recalling the Goldwater-Nichols legislation of 1986, Secretary Rumsfeld reminded us that to achieve better joint capability, each of the armed services had to give up some of their turf and authorities and prerogatives. Today, he said, the executive branch is stovepiped much like the force services were nearly 20 years ago. He wondered if it might be appropriate to ask agencies to give up some of their existing turf and authority in exchange for a stronger, faster, more efficient government-wide joint effort. Privately, other key officials have made the same point to us. We therefore propose a new institution, a civilian-led unified joint command for counterterrorism. It should combine strategic intelligence and joint operational planning. In the Pentagon's joint staff, which serves the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, intelligence is handled by the J2 Directorate, operational planning by J3, and overall policy by J5. Our concept combines the J2 and J3 functions intelligence and operational planning in one agency, keeping overall policy coordination where it belongs, in the National Security Council. Recommendation: we recommend the establishment of a National Counterterrorism Center, NCTC, built on the foundation of the existing Terrorist Threat Integration Center, TTIC. Breaking the older mold of national government organization, this NCTC should be a center for joint operational planning and joint intelligence, staffed by personnel from the various agencies. The head of the NCTC should have authority to evaluate the performance of the people assigned to the center. Such a joint center should be developed in the same spirit that guided the military's creation of unified joint commands, or the shaping of earlier national agencies like the National Reconnaissance Office, which was formed to organize the work of the CIA and several defense agencies in space. NCTC Intelligence. The NCTC should lead strategic analysis, pooling all source intelligence, foreign and domestic, about transnational terrorist organizations with global reach. It should develop net assessments comparing enemy capabilities and intentions against U.S. defenses and countermeasures. It should also provide warning. It should do this work by drawing on the efforts of the CIA, FBI, Homeland Security, and other departments and agencies. It should task collection requirements both inside and outside the United States. The intelligence function J2 should build on the existing TTIC structure and remain distinct as a National Intelligence Center within the NCTC. as the government's principal knowledge bank on Islamist terrorism, with the main responsibility for strategic analysis and net assessment, it should absorb a significant portion of the analytical talent now residing in the CIA's Counterterrorist Center and the DIA's Joint Intelligence Task Force Combating Terrorism JITFCT. NCTC Operations. The NCTC should perform joint planning. The plans would assign operational responsibilities to lead agencies, such as State, the CIA, the FBI, Defense and its Combatant Commands, Homeland Security, and other agencies. The NCTC should not direct the actual execution of these operations, leaving the job to the agencies. The NCTC would then track implementation. It would look across the foreign domestic divide and across agency boundaries, updating plans to follow through on cases. The Joint Operational Planning Function J3 will be new to the TTIC structure. The NCTC can draw on analogous work now being done in the CIA and every other involved department of the government, as well as reaching out to knowledgeable officials in state and local agencies throughout the United States. The NCTC should not be a policy-making body. Its operations and planning should follow the policy direction of the President and the National Security Council. NCTC Authorities. The head of the NCTC should be appointed by the President, and should be equivalent in rank to a deputy head of a cabinet department. The head of the NCTC would report to the National Intelligence Director, an office, whose creation we recommend below, placed in the Executive Office of the President. The head of the NCTC would thus also report indirectly to the President. This official's nomination should be confirmed by the Senate and he or she should testify to the Congress, as is the case now with other statutory presidential offices, like the U.S. Trade Representative. To avoid the fate of other entities with great nominal authority and little real power, the head of the NCTC must have the right to concur in the choices of personnel, to lead the operating entities of the departments and agencies focused on counterterrorism, specifically including the head of the Counterterrorist Center, the head of the FBI's Counterterrorism Division, the commanders of the Defense Department's Special Operations Command and Northern Command, and the State Department's Coordinator for Counterterrorism. 5. The head of the NCTC should also work with the Director of the Office of Management and Budget in developing the President's counterterrorism budget. There are precedents for surrendering authority for joint planning, while preserving an agency's operational control. In the international context, NATO commanders may get line authority over forces assigned by other nations. In U.S. unified commands, commanders plan operations that may involve units belonging to one of the services. In each case, procedures are worked out, formal and informal, to define the limits of the joint commander's authority. The most serious disadvantage of the NCTC is the reverse of its greatest virtue. The struggle against Islamist terrorism is so important that any clear-cut centralization of authority to manage and be accountable for it may concentrate too much power in one place. The proposed NCTC would be given the authority of planning the activities of other agencies. Law or executive order must define the scope of such line authority. The NCTC would not eliminate interagency policy disputes. These would still go to the National Security Council. To improve coordination at the White House, we believe the existing Homeland Security Council should soon be merged into a single National Security Council. The creation of the NCTC should help the NSC staff concentrate on its core duties of assisting the President and supporting interdepartmental policymaking. We recognize that this is a new and difficult idea precisely because the authorities we recommend for the NCTC really would, as Secretary Rumsfeld foresaw, ask strong agencies to give up some of their turf and authority in exchange for a stronger, faster, more efficient government-wide joint effort. Countering transnational Islamist terrorism will test whether the U.S. government can fashion more flexible models of management needed to deal with the 21st century world. An argument against change is that the nation is at war and cannot afford to reorganize in midstream. But some of the main innovations of the 1940s and 1950s, including the creation of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and even the construction of the Pentagon itself, were undertaken in the midst of war. Surely the country cannot wait until the struggle against Islamist terrorism is over. Surprise, when it happens to a government, is likely to be a complicated, diffuse, bureaucratic thing. It includes neglect of responsibility, but also responsibility so poorly defined or so ambiguously delegated that action gets lost. That comment was made more than 40 years ago, about Pearl Harbor. We hope another commission, writing in the future about another attack, does not again find this quotation to be so apt. 13.2 Unity of Effort in the Intelligence Community. In our first section, we concentrated on counterterrorism, discussing how to combine the analysis of information from all sources of intelligence with the joint planning of operations that draw on that analysis. In this section, we step back from looking just at the counterterrorism problem. We reflect on whether the government is organized adequately to direct resources and build the intelligence capabilities it will need not just for countering terrorism, but for the broader range of national security challenges in the decades ahead. The need for a change. During the Cold War, intelligence agencies did not depend on seamless integration to track and count the thousands of military targets, such as tanks and missiles fielded by the Soviet Union and other adversary states. Each agency concentrated on its specialized mission, acquiring its own information and then sharing it via formal, finished reports. The Department of Defense had given birth to and dominated the main agencies for technical collection of intelligence. Resources were shifted at an incremental pace, coping with challenges that arose over years, even decades. We summarize the resulting organization of the intelligence community in Chapter 3. It is outlined below. Members of the U.S. Intelligence Community Office of the Director of Central Intelligence, which includes the Office of the Deputy Director of Central Intelligence for Community Management, the Community Management Staff, the Terrorism Threat Integration Center, the National Intelligence Council, and other community offices. The Central Intelligence Agency CIA, which performs human source collection, all source analysis, and advanced science and technology. National Intelligence Agencies, National Security Agency NSA, which performs signals collection and analysis. National Geospatial Intelligence Agency NGA, which performs imagery collection and analysis. National Reconnaissance Office NRO, which develops, acquires, and launches space systems for intelligence collection. Other national reconnaissance programs. Departmental Intelligence Agencies, Defense Intelligence Agency DIA of the Department of Defense. Intelligence entities of the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines. Bureau of Intelligence and Research INR of the Department of State. Office of Terrorism and Finance Intelligence of the Department of Treasury. Office of Intelligence and the Counterterrorism and Counterintelligence Divisions of the Federal Bureau of Investigation of the Department of Justice. Office of Intelligence of the Department of Energy. Directorate of Information Analysis and Infrastructure Protection IAIP and Directorate of Coast Guard Intelligence of the Department of Homeland Security. The need to restructure the intelligence community grows out of six problems that have become apparent before and after 9/11. Structural barriers to performing joint intelligence work. National intelligence is still organized around the collection disciplines of the home agencies, not the joint mission. The importance of integrated, all-source analysis cannot be overstated. Without it, it is not possible to connect the dots. No one component holds all the relevant information. By contrast, in organizing national defense, the Goldwater-Nichols legislation of 1986 created joint commands for operations in the field, the Unified Command Plan. The services the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine Corps organize, train, and equip their people and units to perform their missions. Then they assign personnel and units to the Joint Combatant Commander, like the Commanding General of the Central Command, CENTCOM. The Goldwater-Nichols Act required officers to serve tours outside their service in order to win promotion. The culture of the Defense Department was transformed. Its collective mindset moved from service-specific to joint, and its operations became more integrated. Lack of common standards and practices across the foreign-domestic divide. The leadership of the intelligence community should be able to pool information gathered overseas with information gathered in the United States, holding the work, wherever it is done, to a common standard of quality in how it is collected, processed, e.g., translated, reported, shared, and analyzed. A common set of personnel standards for intelligence can create a group of professionals better able to operate in joint activities, transcending their own service-specific mindsets. Divided management of national intelligence capabilities. While the CIO was once central to our national intelligence capabilities, following the end of the Cold War it has been less able to influence the use of the nation's imagery and signals intelligence capabilities in three national agencies housed within the Department of Defense, the National Security Agency, the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, and the National Reconnaissance Office. One of the lessons learned from the 1991 Gulf War was the value of national intelligence systems, satellites in particular, in precision warfare. Since that war, the department has appropriately drawn these agencies into its transformation of the military. Helping to orchestrate this transformation is the Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence, a position established by Congress after 9/11. An unintended consequence of these developments has been the far greater demand made by defense on technical systems, leaving the 601 less able to influence how these technical resources are allocated and used. Weak capacity to set priorities and move resources. The agencies are mainly organized around what they collect or the way they collect it. But the priorities for collection are national. As the 601 makes hard choices about moving resources, he or she must have the power to reach across agencies and reallocate effort to many jobs. The 601 now has at least three jobs. He is expected to run a particular agency, the CIA. He is expected to manage the loose confederation of agencies, that is the intelligence community. He is expected to be the analyst-in-chief for the government, sifting evidence and directly briefing the president as his principal intelligence advisor. No recent 601 has been able to do all three effectively. Usually what loses out is management of the intelligence community, a difficult task even in the best case, because the 601's current authorities are weak. With so much to do, the 601 often has not used even the authority he has. Too complex and secret. Over the decades, the agencies and the rules surrounding the intelligence community have accumulated to a depth that practically defies public comprehension. There are now 15 agencies or parts of agencies in the intelligence community. The community and the 601's authorities have become arcane matters, understood only by initiates after long study. Even the most basic information about how much money is actually allocated to or within the intelligence community, and most of its key components, is shrouded from public view. The current 601 is responsible for community performance, but lacks the three authorities critical for any agency head or chief executive officer: 1. Control over purse strings, 2. The ability to hire or fire senior managers, and 3. The ability to set standards for the information infrastructure and personnel. The only budget power of the 601 over agencies other than the CIO lies in coordinating the budget requests of the various intelligence agencies into a single program for submission to Congress. The overall funding request of the 15 intelligence entities in this program is then presented to the President and Congress in 15 separate volumes. When Congress passes an appropriations bill to allocate money to intelligence agencies, most of their funding is hidden in the Defense Department in order to keep intelligence spending secret. Therefore, although the House and Senate Intelligence Committees are the authorizing committees for funding of the intelligence community, the final budget review is handled in the Defense Subcommittee of the Appropriations Committees. Those committees have no subcommittees just for intelligence, and only a few members and staff review the requests. The appropriations for the CIA and the National Intelligence Agencies, NSA, INGA, and NRO, are then given to the Secretary of Defense. The Secretary transfers the CIA's money to the 601, but disperses the national agency's money directly. Money for the FBI's national security components falls within the appropriations for commerce, justice, and state and goes to the Attorney General. In addition, the 601 lacks hire and fire authority over most of the intelligence community's senior managers. For the national intelligence agencies housed in the Defense Department, the Secretary of Defense must seek the 601's concurrence regarding the nomination of these directors, who are presidentially appointed. But the Secretary may submit recommendations to the President without receiving this concurrence. The 601 cannot fire these officials. The 601 has even less influence over the head of the FBI's national security component, who is appointed by the Attorney General in consultation with the 601. Combining joint work with stronger management. We have received recommendations on the topic of intelligence reform from many sources. Other commissions have been over this same ground. Thoughtful bills have been introduced, most recently a bill by the chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Porter Gosar Fla, and another by the ranking minority member, Jane Harman D. California. In the Senate, Senators Bob Graham D. Fla and Dianne Feinstein D. California have introduced reform proposals as well. Past efforts have foundered, because the President did not support them, because the 601, the Secretary of Defense, or both opposed them, and because some proposals lacked merit. We have tried to take stock of these experiences, and borrow from strong elements in many of the ideas that have already been developed by others. Recommendation: the current position of Director of Central Intelligence should be replaced by a National Intelligence Director with two main areas of responsibility, one to oversee national intelligence centers on specific subjects of interest across the U.S. government and two, to manage the national intelligence program, and oversee the agencies that contribute to it. First, the National Intelligence Director should oversee national intelligence centers, to provide all source analysis and plan intelligence operations for the whole government on major problems. One such problem is counterterrorism. In this case, we believe that the center should be the intelligence entity formerly TTIC inside the National Counterterrorism Center we have proposed. It would sit there alongside the Operations Management Unit we described earlier, with both making up the NCTC, in the Executive Office of the President. Other national intelligence centers, for instance, on counterproliferation, crime and narcotics, and China would be housed in whatever department or agency is best suited for them. The National Intelligence Director would retain the present 601's role as the principal intelligence advisor to the President. We hope the President will come to look directly to the directors of the National Intelligence Centers to provide all source analysis in their areas of responsibility, balancing the advice of these intelligence chiefs against the contrasting viewpoints that may be offered by department heads at State, Defense, Homeland Security, Justice, and other agencies. Second, the National Intelligence Director should manage the National Intelligence Program and oversee the component agencies of the intelligence community. See diagram. The National Intelligence Director would submit a unified budget for national intelligence that reflects priorities chosen by the National Security Council, an appropriate balance among the varieties of technical and human intelligence collection and analysis. He or she would receive an appropriation for national intelligence and apportion the funds to the appropriate agencies, in line with that budget, and with authority to reprogram funds among the national intelligence agencies to meet any new priority, as counterterrorism was in the 1990s. The National Intelligence Director should approve and submit nominations to the President of the individuals who would lead the CIA, DIA, FBI Intelligence Office, NSA, INGA, NRO, Information Analysis and Infrastructure Protection Directorate of the Department of Homeland Security, and other national intelligence capabilities. The National Intelligence Director would manage this national effort with the help of three deputies, each of whom would also hold a key position in one of the component agencies. Foreign Intelligence. The head of the CIA Defense Intelligence, the Undersecretary of Defense for Intelligence, Homeland Intelligence, the FBI's Executive Assistant Director for Intelligence, or the Undersecretary of Homeland Security for Information Analysis and Infrastructure Protection. Other agencies in the intelligence community would coordinate their work within each of these three areas, largely staying housed in the same departments or agencies that support them now. Returning to the analogy of the Defense Department's organization, these three deputies, like the leaders of the Army, Navy, Air Force, or Marines, would have the job of acquiring the systems, training the people, and executing the operations planned by the National Intelligence Centers. And, just as the combatant commanders also report to the Secretary of Defense, the directors of the National Intelligence Centers, e.g., for counterproliferation, crime and narcotics, and the rest also would report to the National Intelligence Director. The Defense Department's Military Intelligence Programs. The Joint Military Intelligence Program, JMIP, and the Tactical Intelligence and Related Activities Program, TIARA, would remain part of that department's responsibility. The National Intelligence Director would set personnel policies to establish standards for education and training, and facilitate assignments at the National Intelligence Centers and across agency lines. The National Intelligence Director also would set information sharing and information technology policies to maximize data sharing, as well as policies to protect the security of information. Too many agencies now have an opportunity to say no to change. The National Intelligence Director should participate in an NSC Executive Committee that can resolve differences in priorities among the agencies and bring the major disputes to the President for decision. The National Intelligence Director should be located in the Executive Office of the President. This official, who would be confirmed by the Senate and would testify before Congress, would have a relatively small staff of several hundred people, taking the place of the existing community management offices housed at the CIA. In managing the whole community, the National Intelligence Director is still providing a service function. With the partial exception of his or her responsibilities for overseeing the NCTC, the National Intelligence Director should support the consumers of national intelligence, the President and policy-making advisors, such as the Secretaries of State, Defense, and Homeland Security, and the Attorney General. We are wary of too easily equating government management problems with those of the private sector. But we have noticed that some very large private firms rely on a powerful CEO, who has significant control over how money is spent, and can hire or fire leaders of the major divisions, assisted by a relatively modest staff, while leaving responsibility for execution in the operating divisions. There are disadvantages to separating the position of National Intelligence Director from the job of heading the CIA. For example, the National Intelligence Director will not head a major agency of his or her own and may have a weaker base of support. But we believe that these disadvantages are outweighed by several other considerations. The National Intelligence Director must be able to directly oversee intelligence collection inside the United States. Yet law and custom has counseled against giving such a plain domestic role to the head of the CIA. The CIA will be one among several claimants for funds in setting national priorities. The National Intelligence Director should not be both one of the advocates and the judge of them all. Covert operations tend to be highly tactical, requiring close attention. The National Intelligence Director should rely on the relevant Joint Mission Center to oversee these details, helping to coordinate closely with the White House. The CIA will be able to concentrate on building the capabilities to carry out such operations and on providing the personnel who will be directing and executing such operations in the field. Rebuilding the analytic and human intelligence collection capabilities of the CIA should be a full-time effort, and the director of the CIO should focus on extending its comparative advantages. Recommendation: the CIO director should emphasize a rebuilding the CIO's analytic capabilities, be transforming the clandestine service by building its human intelligence capabilities, C. developing a stronger language program with high standards and sufficient financial incentives, D. renewing emphasis on recruiting diversity among operations officers so they can blend more easily in foreign cities, E. ensuring a seamless relationship between human source collection and signals collection at the operational level, and F. stressing a better balance between unilateral and liaison operations. The CIO should retain responsibility for the direction and execution of clandestine and covert operations, as assigned by the relevant National Intelligence Center and authorized by the National Intelligence Director and the President. This would include propaganda, renditions, and non-military disruption. We believe, however, that one important area of responsibility should change. Recommendation: lead responsibility for directing and executing paramilitary operations, whether clandestine or covert, should shift to the Defense Department. There it should be consolidated with the capabilities for training, direction, and execution of such operations already being developed in the Special Operations Command. Before 9/11, the CIA did not invest in developing a robust capability to conduct paramilitary operations with U.S. personnel. It relied on proxies instead, organized by CIA operatives without the requisite military training. The results were unsatisfactory. Whether the price is measured in either money or people, the United States cannot afford to build two separate capabilities for carrying out secret military operations, secretly operating standoff missiles, and secretly training foreign military or paramilitary forces. The United States should concentrate responsibility and necessary legal authorities in one entity. The post-9/11 Afghanistan precedent of using joint CIA military teams for covert and clandestine operations was a good one. We believe this proposal to be consistent with it. Each agency would concentrate on its comparative advantages in building capabilities for joint missions. The operation itself would be planned in common. The CIA has a reputation for agility in operations. The military has a reputation for being methodical and cumbersome. We do not know if these stereotypes match current reality. They may also be one more symptom of the civil-military misunderstandings we described in Chapter 4. It is a problem to be resolved in policy guidance and agency management, not in the creation of redundant, overlapping capabilities and authorities in such sensitive work. The CIA's experts should be integrated into the military's training, exercises, and planning. To quote a CIA official now serving in the field, "One fight, one team." Recommendation: finally, to combat the secrecy and complexity we have described, the overall amounts of money being appropriated for national intelligence and to its component agencies should no longer be kept secret. Congress should pass a separate Appropriations Act for intelligence, defending the broad allocation of how these tens of billions of dollars have been assigned among the varieties of intelligence work. The specifics of the intelligence appropriation would remain classified, as they are today. Opponents of declassification argue that America's enemies could learn about intelligence capabilities by tracking the top-line appropriations figure. Yet the top-line figure by itself provides little insight into U.S. intelligence sources and methods. The U.S. government readily provides copious information about spending on its military forces, including military intelligence. The intelligence community should not be subject to that much disclosure. But when even aggregate categorical numbers remain hidden, it is hard to judge priorities and foster accountability. 13.3 Unity of Effort in Sharing Information. Information Sharing. We have already stressed the importance of intelligence analysis that can draw on all relevant sources of information. The biggest impediment to all source analysis to a greater likelihood of connecting the dots is the human or systemic resistance to sharing information. The U.S. government has access to a vast amount of information. When databases not usually thought of as intelligence, such as customs or immigration information, are included, the storehouse is immense. But the U.S. government has a weak system for processing and using what it has. In interviews around the government, official after official urged us to call attention to frustrations with the unglamorous back-office side of government operations. In the 9/11 story, for example, we sometimes see examples of information that could be accessed like the undistributed NSA information that would have helped identify Nawaf al-Hazmi in January 2000. But someone had to ask for it. In that case, no one did. Or, as in the episodes we describe in Chapter 8, the information is distributed, but in a compartmented channel. Or the information is available, and someone does ask, but it cannot be shared. What all these stories have in common is a system that requires a demonstrated need to know before sharing. This approach as soon as it is possible to know, in advance, who will need to use the information. Such a system implicitly assumes that the risk of inadvertent disclosure outweighs the benefits of wider sharing. Those Cold War assumptions are no longer appropriate. The culture of agencies feeling they own the information they gathered at taxpayer expense must be replaced by a culture in which the agencies instead feel they have a duty to the information, to repay the taxpayer's investment by making that information available. Each intelligence agency has its own security practices, outgrowths of the Cold War. We certainly understand the reason for these practices. Counterintelligence concerns are still real, even if the old Soviet enemy has been replaced by other spies. But the security concerns need to be weighed against the costs. Current security requirements nurture overclassification and excessive compartmentation of information among agencies. Each agency's incentive structure opposes sharing, with risks criminal, civil, and internal administrative sanctions but few rewards for sharing information. No one has to pay the long-term costs of overclassifying information, though these costs even in literal financial terms are substantial. There are no punishments for not sharing information. Agencies uphold a need-to-know culture of information protection rather than promoting a need-to-share culture of integration. Recommendation: Information procedures should provide incentives for sharing to restore a better balance between security and shared knowledge. Intelligence gathered about transnational terrorism should be processed, turned into reports, and distributed according to the same quality standards, whether it is collected in Pakistan or in Texas. The logical objection is that sources and methods may vary greatly in different locations. We therefore propose that when a report is first created, its data be separated from the sources and methods by which they are obtained. The report should begin with the information in its most shareable, but still meaningful, form. Therefore, the maximum number of recipients can access some form of that information. If knowledge of further details becomes important, any user can query further, with access granted or denied according to the rules set for the network and with queries leaving an audit trail, in order to determine who accessed the information. But the questions may not come at all, unless experts at the edge of the network can readily discover the clues that prompt to them. We propose that information be shared horizontally, across new networks that transcend individual agencies. The current system is structured on an old mainframe, or hub and spoke, concept. In this older approach, each agency has its own database. Agency users send information to the database and then can retrieve it from the database. A decentralized network model, the concept behind much of the information revolution, shares data horizontally too. Agencies would still have their own databases, but those databases would be searchable across agency lines. In this system, secrets are protected through the design of the network and an information rights management approach that controls access to the data, not access to the whole network. An outstanding conceptual framework for this kind of trusted information network has been developed by a task force of leading professionals in national security, Information Technology, and Law assembled by the Markle Foundation. Its report has been widely discussed throughout the U.S. government, but has not yet been converted into action. Recommendation: the President should lead the government-wide effort to bring the major national security institutions into the information revolution. He should coordinate the resolution of the legal, policy, and technical issues across agencies to create a trusted information network. No one agency can do it alone. Well-meaning agency officials are under tremendous pressure to update their systems. Alone, they may only be able to modernize the stovepipes, not replace them. Only presidential leadership can develop government-wide concepts and standards. Currently, no one is doing this job. Backed by the Office of Management and Budget, a new National Intelligence Director empowered to set common standards for information use throughout the community, and a Secretary of Homeland Security, who helps extend the system to public agencies and relevant private sector databases, a government-wide initiative can succeed. White House leadership is also needed because the policy and legal issues are harder than the technical ones. The necessary technology already exists. What does not are the rules for acquiring, accessing, sharing, and using the vast stores of public and private data that may be available. When information sharing works, it is a powerful tool. Therefore, the sharing and uses of information must be guided by a set of practical policy guidelines that simultaneously empower and constrain officials, telling them clearly what is and is not permitted. This is government acting in new ways to face new threats, the most recent Markle report explains. And while such change is necessary, it must be accomplished while engendering the people's trust that privacy and other civil liberties are being protected, that businesses are not being unduly burdened with requests for extraneous or useless information, that taxpayer money is being well spent, and that, ultimately, the network will be effective in protecting our security. The authors add, leadership is emerging from all levels of government and from many places in the private sector. What is needed now is a plan to accelerate these efforts, and public debate and consensus on the goals. 13.4 Unity of effort in the Congress. Strengthen congressional oversight of intelligence and homeland security. Of all our recommendations, strengthening congressional oversight may be among the most difficult and important. So long as oversight is governed by current congressional rules and resolutions, we believe the American people will not get the security they want and need. The United States needs a strong, stable, and capable congressional committee structure to give America's national intelligence agencies oversight, support, and leadership. Few things are more difficult to change in Washington than congressional committee jurisdiction and prerogatives. To a member, these assignments are almost as important as the map of his or her congressional district. The American people may have to insist that these changes occur, or they may well not happen. Having interviewed numerous members of Congress from both parties, as well as congressional staff members, we found that dissatisfaction with congressional oversight remains widespread. The future challenges of America's intelligence agencies are daunting. They include the need to develop leading-edge technologies that give our policymakers and warfighters a decisive edge in any conflict where the interests of the United States are vital. Not only does good intelligence win wars, but the best intelligence enables us to prevent them from happening altogether. Under the terms of existing rules and resolutions, the House and Senate Intelligence Committees lack the power, influence, and sustained capability to meet this challenge. While few members of Congress have the broad knowledge of intelligence activities or the know-how about the technologies employed, all members need to feel assured that good oversight is happening. When their unfamiliarity with the subject is combined with the need to preserve security, a mandate emerges for substantial change. Tinkering with the existing structure is not sufficient. Either Congress should create a joint committee for intelligence, using the Joint Atomic Energy Committee as its model, or it should create House and Senate committees with combined authorizing and appropriations powers. Whichever of these two forms are chosen, The goals should be a structure-codified by resolution with powers expressly granted and carefully limited-allowing a relatively small group of members of Congress, given time and reason to master the subject and the agencies, to conduct oversight of the intelligence establishment, and be clearly accountable for their work. The staff of this committee should be nonpartisan and work for the entire committee and not for individual members. The other reforms we have suggested for a National Counterterrorism Center and a National Intelligence Director will not work if congressional oversight does not change too. Unity of effort in executive management can be lost if it is fractured by divided congressional oversight. Recommendation: Congressional oversight for intelligence and counterterrorism is now dysfunctional. Congress should address this problem. We have considered various alternatives. A joint committee on the old model of the Joint Committee on Atomic Energy is one. A single committee in each House of Congress, combining authorizing and appropriating authorities, is another. The new committee or committees should conduct continuing studies of the activities of the intelligence agencies and report problems relating to the development and use of intelligence to all members of the House and Senate. We have already recommended that the total level of funding for intelligence be made public, and that the National Intelligence Program be appropriated to the National Intelligence Director, not to the Secretary of Defense. We also recommend that the Intelligence Committee should have a subcommittee specifically dedicated to oversight, freed from the consuming responsibility of working on the budget. The resolution creating the new Intelligence Committee structure should grant subpoena authority to the committee or committees. The majority party's representation on this committee should never exceed the minority's representation by more than one. Four of the members appointed to this committee or committees should be a member who also serves on each of the following additional committees: Armed Services, Judiciary, Foreign Affairs, and the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee. In this way, the other major congressional interests can be brought together in the new committee's work. Members should serve indefinitely on the intelligence committees, without set terms, thereby letting them accumulate expertise. The committees should be smaller, perhaps 7 or 9 members in each house, so that each member feels a greater sense of responsibility and accountability for the quality of the committee's work. The leaders of the Department of Homeland Security now appear before 88 committees and subcommittees of Congress. One expert witness, not a member of the administration, told us that this is perhaps the single largest obstacle impeding the department's successful development. The one attempt to consolidate such committee authority, the House Select Committee on Homeland Security, may be eliminated. The Senate does not have even this. Congress needs to establish for the Department of Homeland Security the kind of clear authority and responsibility that exists to enable the Justice Department to deal with crime and the Defense Department to deal with threats to national security. Through not more than one authorizing committee and one appropriating subcommittee in each House, Congress should be able to ask the Secretary of Homeland Security whether he or she has the resources to provide reasonable security against major terrorist acts within the United States, and to hold the Secretary accountable for the Department's performance. Recommendation: Congress should create a single, principal point of oversight and review for Homeland Security. Congressional leaders are best able to judge what committee should have jurisdiction over this department and its duties. But we believe that Congress does have the obligation to choose one in the House and one in the Senate, and that this committee should be a permanent standing committee with a nonpartisan staff. Improve the transitions between administrations. In Chapter 6, we described the transition of 2000 to 2000. Beyond the policy issues we described, the new administration did not have its deputy cabinet officers in place until the spring of 2001, and the critical sub-cabinet officials were not confirmed until the summer, if then. In other words, the new administration, like others before it, did not have its team on the job until at least 6 months after it took office. Recommendation: Since a catastrophic attack could occur with little or no notice, we should minimize as much as possible the disruption of national security policy making during the change of administrations by accelerating the process for national security appointments. We think the process could be improved significantly so transitions can work more effectively and allow new officials to assume their new responsibilities as quickly as possible. Before the election, candidates should submit the names of selected members of their prospective transition teams to the FBI so that, if necessary, those team members can obtain security clearances immediately after the election is over. A president-elect should submit lists of possible candidates for national security positions, to begin obtaining security clearances immediately after the election, so that their background investigations can be complete before January 20. A single federal agency should be responsible for providing and maintaining security clearances, ensuring uniform standards including uniform security questionnaires and financial report requirements, and maintaining a single database. This agency can also be responsible for administering polygraph tests on behalf of organizations that require them. A president-elect should submit the nominations of the entire new national security team through the level of Undersecretary of Cabinet Departments, not later than January 20. The Senate, in return, should adopt special rules requiring hearings and votes to confirm or reject national security nominees within 30 days of their submission. The Senate should not require confirmation of such executive appointees below Executive Level 3. The outgoing administration should provide the President-elect, as soon as possible after Election Day, with a classified, compartmented list that catalogs specific, operational threats to national security, major military or covert operations, and pending decisions on the possible use of force. Such a document could provide both notice and a checklist, inviting a president-elect to inquire and learn more. 13.5 Organizing America's Defenses in the United States. The future role of the FBI. We have considered proposals for a new agency dedicated to intelligence collection in the United States. Some call this a proposal for an American Miles 5, although the analogy is weak. The actual British Security Service is a relatively small worldwide agency that combines duties assigned in the U.S. government to the Terrorist Threat Integration Center, the CIA, the FBI, and the Department of Homeland Security. The concern about the FBI is that it has long favored its criminal justice mission over its national security mission. Part of the reason for this is the demand around the country for FBI help on criminal matters. The FBI was criticized, rightly, for the overzealous domestic intelligence investigations disclosed during the 1970s. The pendulum swung away from those types of investigations during the 1980s and 1990s, though the FBI maintained an active counterintelligence function, and was the lead agency for the investigation of foreign terrorist groups operating inside the United States. We do not recommend the creation of a new domestic intelligence agency. It is not needed, if our other recommendations are adopted to establish a strong National Intelligence Center, part of the NCTC, that will oversee counterterrorism intelligence work, foreign and domestic, and to create a National Intelligence Director, who can set and enforce standards for the collection, processing, and reporting of information. Under the structures we recommend, the FBI's role is focused, but still vital. The FBI does need to be able to direct its thousands of agents and other employees to collect intelligence in America's cities and towns, interviewing informants, conducting surveillance and searches, tracking individuals, working collaboratively with local authorities, and doing so with meticulous attention to detail and compliance with the law. The FBI's job in the streets of the United States would thus be a domestic equivalent, operating under the U.S. Constitution and quite different laws and rules, to the job of the CIA's operations officers abroad. Creating a new domestic intelligence agency has other drawbacks. The FBI is accustomed to carrying out sensitive intelligence collection operations in compliance with the law. If a new domestic intelligence agency were outside of the Department of Justice, the process of legal oversight never easy could become even more difficult. Abuses of civil liberties could create a backlash that would impair the collection of needed intelligence. Creating a new domestic intelligence agency would divert attention of the officials most responsible for current counterterrorism efforts, while the threat remains high. Putting a new player into the mix of federal agencies with counterterrorism responsibilities would exacerbate existing information sharing problems. A new domestic intelligence agency would need to acquire assets and personnel. The FBI already has 28,000 employees, 56 field offices, 400 satellite offices, and 47 legal attaché offices, a laboratory, operations center, and training facility, an existing network of informants, cooperating defendants, and other sources, and relationships with state and local law enforcement, the CIA, and foreign intelligence and law enforcement agencies. Counterterrorism investigations in the United States very quickly become matters that involve violations of criminal law and possible law enforcement action. Because the FBI can have agents working criminal matters and agents working intelligence investigations concerning the same international terrorism target, the full range of investigative tools against a suspected terrorist can be considered within one agency. The removal of the wall that existed before 9/11 between intelligence and law enforcement has opened up new opportunities for cooperative action within the FBI. Counterterrorism investigations often overlap or are cued by other criminal investigations, such as money laundering or the smuggling of contraband. In the field, the close connection to criminal work has many benefits. Our recommendation to leave counterterrorism intelligence collection in the United States with the FBI still depends on an assessment that the FBI, if it makes an all-out effort to institutionalize change, can do the job. As we mentioned in Chapter 3, we have been impressed by the determination that agents display in tracking down details, patiently going the extra mile and working the extra month to put facts in the place of speculation. In our report, we have shown how agents in Phoenix, Minneapolis, and New York displayed initiative in pressing their investigations. FBI agents and analysts in the field need to have sustained support and dedicated resources to become stronger intelligence officers. They need to be rewarded for acquiring informants and for gathering and disseminating information differently and more broadly than usual in a traditional criminal investigation. FBI employees need to report and analyze what they have learned in ways the Bureau has never done before. Under Director Robert Mueller, the Bureau has made significant progress in improving its intelligence capabilities. It now has an Office of Intelligence, overseen by the top tier of FBI management. Field intelligence groups have been created in all field offices to put FBI priorities and the emphasis on intelligence into practice. Advances have been made in improving the Bureau's information technology systems and in increasing connectivity and information sharing with intelligence community agencies. Director Mueller has also recognized that the FBI's reforms are far from complete. He has outlined a number of areas where added measures may be necessary. Specifically, he has recognized that the FBI needs to recruit from a broader pool of candidates, that agents and analysts working on national security matters require specialized training, and that agents should specialize within programs after obtaining a generalist foundation. The FBI is developing career tracks for agents to specialize in counterterrorism, counterintelligence, cyber crimes, criminal investigations, or intelligence. It is establishing a program for certifying agents as intelligence officers, a certification that will be a prerequisite for promotion to the senior ranks of the Bureau. New training programs have been instituted for intelligence-related subjects. The director of the FBI has proposed creating an intelligence directorate as a further refinement of the FBI intelligence program. This directorate would include units for intelligence planning and policy and for the direction of analysts and linguists. We want to ensure that the Bureau's shift to a preventive counterterrorism posture is more fully institutionalized, so that it survives beyond Director Mueller's tenure. We have found that in the past the Bureau has announced its willingness to reform and restructure itself to address transnational security threats, but has fallen short, failing to effect the necessary institutional and cultural changes organization-wide. We want to ensure that this does not happen again. Despite having found acceptance of the director's clear message that counterterrorism is now the FBI's top priority, 2 years after 9/11 we also found gaps between some of the announced reforms and the reality in the field. We are concerned that management in the field offices still can allocate people and resources to local concerns that diverge from the national security mission. This system could revert to a focus on lower priority criminal justice cases over national security requirements. Recommendation: A specialized and integrated national security workforce should be established at the FBI consisting of agents, analysts, linguists, and surveillance specialists who are recruited, trained, rewarded, and retained to ensure the development of an institutional culture imbued with a deep expertise in intelligence and national security. The President, by executive order or directive, should direct the FBI to develop this intelligence cadre. Recognizing that cross-fertilization between the criminal justice and national security disciplines is vital to the success of both missions, all new agents should receive basic training in both areas. Furthermore, new agents should begin their careers with meaningful assignments in both areas. Agents and analysts should then specialize in one of these disciplines and have the option to work such matters for their entire career with the Bureau. Certain advanced training courses and assignments to other intelligence agencies should be required to advance within the national security discipline. In the interest of cross-fertilization, all senior FBI managers, including those working on law enforcement matters, should be certified intelligence officers. The FBI should fully implement a recruiting, hiring, and selection process for agents and analysts that enhances its ability to target and attract individuals with educational and professional backgrounds in intelligence, international relations, language, technology, and other relevant skills. The FBI should institute the integration of analysts, agents, linguists, and surveillance personnel in the field so that a dedicated team approach is brought to bear on national security intelligence operations. Each field office should have an official at the field office's deputy level for national security matters. This individual would have management oversight and ensure that the national priorities are carried out in the field. The FBI should align its budget structure according to its four main programs: intelligence, counterterrorism and counterintelligence, criminal, and criminal justice services to ensure better transparency on program costs, management of resources, and protection of the intelligence program. The FBI should report regularly to Congress in its semi-annual program reviews designed to identify whether each field office is appropriately addressing FBI and national program priorities. The FBI should report regularly to Congress in detail on the qualifications, status, and roles of analysts in the field and at headquarters. Congress should ensure that analysts are afforded training and career opportunities on a par with those offered analysts in other intelligence community agencies. The Congress should make sure funding is available to accelerate the expansion of secure facilities in FBI field offices so as to increase their ability to use secure email systems and classified intelligence product exchanges. The Congress should monitor whether the FBI's information sharing principles are implemented in practice. The FBI is just a small fraction of the national law enforcement community in the United States, a community comprised mainly of state and local agencies. The network designed for sharing information and the work of the FBI through local joint terrorism task forces should build a reciprocal relationship in which state and local agents understand what information they are looking for and, in return, receive some of the information being developed about what is happening or may happen in their communities. In this relationship, the Department of Homeland Security also will play an important part. The Homeland Security Act of 2002 gave the Undersecretary for Information Analysis and Infrastructure Protection broad responsibilities. In practice, this directorate has the job to map terrorist threats to the homeland against our assist vulnerabilities, in order to drive our efforts to protect against terrorist threats. These capabilities are still embryonic. The directorate has not yet developed the capacity to perform one of its assigned jobs, which is to assimilate and analyze information from Homeland Security's own component agencies, such as the Coast Guard, Secret Service, Transportation Security Administration, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and Customs and Border Protection. The Secretary of Homeland Security must ensure that these components work with the Information Analysis and Infrastructure Protection Directorate, so that this office can perform its mission. Homeland Defense. At several points in our inquiry, we asked, who is responsible for defending us at home? Our national defense at home is the responsibility, first, of the Department of Defense and, second, of the Department of Homeland Security. They must have clear delineations of responsibility and authority. We found that NORAD, which had been given the responsibility for defending U.S. airspace, had construed that mission to focus on threats coming from outside America's borders. It did not adjust its focus, even though the intelligence community had gathered intelligence on the possibility that terrorists might turn to hijacking, and even use of planes as missiles. We have been assured that NORAD has now embraced the full mission. Northern Command has been established to assume responsibility for the defense of the domestic United States. Recommendation: the Department of Defense and its oversight committees should regularly assess the adequacy of Northern Command's strategies and planning to defend the United States against military threats to the homeland. The Department of Homeland Security was established to consolidate all of the domestic agencies responsible for securing America's borders and national infrastructure, most of which is in private hands. It should identify those elements of our transportation, energy, communications, financial, and other institutions that need to be protected, develop plans to protect that infrastructure, and exercise the mechanisms to enhance preparedness. This means going well beyond the pre-existing jobs of the agencies that have been brought together inside the department. Recommendation: the Department of Homeland Security and its oversight committees should regularly assess the types of threats the country faces to determine the adequacy of the government's plans and the progress against those plans to protect America's critical infrastructure and be the readiness of the government to respond to the threats that the United States might face. We look forward to a national debate on the merits of what we have recommended, and we will participate vigorously in that debate. Edited and licensed for text-to-speech by FreeClassicAudiobooks.com. Copyright 2004.